This is amazing. This is the very first time that we've ever been able to look at a single base in the human genome and say, we know this particular base is important.
Welcome to Translation. I'm Seth Bannon, a founding partner at 50 Years, a venture capital firm backing founders using technology to solve the world's biggest problems. Translation is the process of turning basic scientific research into therapies that cure disease, new sources of energy that heal the planet, and other things that move the world forward. This podcast takes a deep dive into scientific achievements with huge potential to improve society. We talk directly with the people advancing the science with their own hands and minds, and focus on how we can translate the science from the bench to the benefit of all. Welcome to Translation.
Behind every success, there are people with the courage to try.
To create new sources of energy, to fix the carbon in our atmosphere, to cure disease.
Hey everyone, it's Ayush Nuri, student at Harvard, biology fellow at 50 Years, and co-host of the Translation Podcast with Ashton Trotman Grant. In this episode, we're chatting with Linda Goodman, the co-founder and chief technology officer at Fauna Bio. Millions of people die every year from chronic diseases, and traditional drug discovery has failed in identifying solutions to many of these persistent health challenges. Functional genomics is offering a way forward by identifying gene networks and enabling the development of drugs with very specific targets that underlie these diseases. But rather than just relying on gene targets within humans, Linda and her company, Fauna Bio, is casting a wider net across the animal kingdom. Extreme adaptation is common across many mammals, giving us an incredible pool of potential targets to go after. Whereas a single heart attack can kill a person, certain animals not only survive 25 heart attacks a year, but go on to thrive, living two times longer than other mammals their size. By identifying and understanding the gene networks underlying these extreme adaptations, Fauna Bio can then identify targets across 415 different species, map them to human genes, and develop drugs that exploit our natural protective physiological mechanisms. Hey Linda, thanks so much for joining us on Translation. Before we dive into the science and the technology, we'd love to learn more about your personal story. What got you interested in science in the first place?
Thank you very much for having me on your podcast. Mm-hmm. I'm excited to be here, not only because I'm excited about what you all are doing, but also I am a neighbor. I live two blocks away. I often co-work in the 50 years space, so it's great to be here.
We're happy to have you.
Yeah, and in terms of what got me into science, you know, as a small child, I feel like I came from a fairly scientifically oriented family. Both my parents are physicians. My dad, I think, always sort of wished he'd been a scientist, namely a physicist. And even when I was a tiny kid, we were doing Friday night science experiments in my house. So we were already being incepted at a young age that this was a cool thing to
be
doing.
What kind of experiments?
You know, a lot of them were those little chemistry test kits for kids that bubble or change colors or something like that. They just do something kind of unexpected that makes you think, wow, there's something very interesting and powerful here. And as I got older, I graduated from high school around the time that the human gene or the first draft of the human genome was released. And I think that's very common for people who are doing genetics and genomics in my generation. They were inspired by this project. And at that time, I think there was this idea that, okay, now we have the source code. We can go through and figure out what the bugs are, and then we can solve all of human disease. And there really was this optimism around that time that it felt almost like a race, that it would just be about the groups that could get the first case control data sets for all of the diseases, find, you know, say 300 cases, 300 controls for, you know, diabetes or autism. And then we would know the problems and we could solve them. And I think I was inspired by that optimism. But of course, this turned out to not remotely be the case. That, as it turns out, human genomics, particularly for common diseases, is highly complex. And in retrospect, this makes quite a bit of sense from an evolutionary standpoint, Because, of course, if there were just a couple genes that were causing these fairly common diseases, why would these have mutations risen to high frequency in human populations? There's no reason for that. They would have been selected out if it were just a couple mutations. And so in retrospect, that model didn't make any sense from an evolutionary standpoint. And of course, the field gradually came to the realization that, in fact, it's highly complicated for all of these diseases. We're looking at hundreds, if not thousands, of mutations that are contributing. And so the problem is a lot more complex than we thought. It requires many times larger data sets than people originally thought.
So you're learning about this when you're in high school, right? Where were you growing up? Were you growing up close to the nexus of biology?
So I grew up in Orange County, California. So probably not a nexus for things like that. I was excited about the human genome. And I think that's one of the main reasons that I pursued biology in college, which I did at UC San Diego.
And your experience at UC San Diego pursuing biology, I mean, this was the prime time of innovation, I suppose, for genomics. And you mentioned the Human Genome Project. What was your experience like? And when you were at UC San Diego, were there things that you did that really sort of kindled your love of biology and increased your knowledge?
Yes. So very early on, I actually got into an evolutionary biology lab. Mm-hmm. This was Hopi Hoekstra's lab.
I'm familiar, yeah.
She's amazing. She studies the paramyscus mice. And at the time, we were studying coat color differentiation between inland mice, which are darker in color, and then beach mice, which are lighter in color, and trying to track the mutations that were responsible for this. So yeah, I really doubled down in studying evolution in college. But I always kept in the back of my mind that this is going to relate to human disease. We just need to figure out how to do that.
I remember quite some time ago, I think I saw a talk from somebody in Hopi's lab on, I suspect, a very similar concept. I remember it was on mice, and I remember actually, I think there were a couple of slides on the beach mice project. So nice connection. Where was your journey after college? How did you continue to study biology?
So it's interesting. Towards the end of my undergraduate studies, it was starting to become very obvious that the key issue, now that we had the human genome and sequencing costs were dropping, it really became an issue of these large data sets and mm-hmm. how do we deal with analyzing large data sets. And biologists, pure biologists, don't really have the training to be doing that. And so I really realized toward the end of college that I had this gap in knowledge, and I started taking coding classes. And from there, I moved on to study at Cambridge University in England to get a master's in computational biology, because that was just very obviously where this field was heading.
Yeah. Yep.
And if you did not understand how to analyze large amounts of data, you're going to get left behind.
Yeah. So while you were at Cambridge, what kind of things did you get into? I know you're involved with iGEM. I'd love to learn a bit more about that.
Oh, yeah. So I was involved in iGEM. We were essentially trying to modify populations of Bacillus subtilis to make these interesting patterns. And also, I think the idea at the time is that you could really compartmentalize many different parts of these gene circuits to make things work exactly how you wanted. But of course, biology is much more complicated than that. And I would say, you know, we ended up with a project that worked and we were excited about. But I also thought, wow, that was really hard. And a lot of people look at this as we can just straight away engineer biology and that's going to work. But the reality of it is it's different from, you know, my grandfather was very early on doing electrical engineering. He used to set up circuits in, he was a farmer at the time. He used to set up circuits in one of the barns, and he had, you know, really high voltage cables exposed.
Wow.
But he was able to do a lot, and, you know, he had ham radio very early on. And in some ways, their battle was a bit easier because they literally could just hook up circuits that they fully understood and have them function in the way that they wanted. But biology is just really messy, and you can get there, but it's much more cumbersome and time-consuming, I think, than I had thought at the outset.
And when did you, was it at Cambridge or was it working in Hopi's lab? When did you personally start to come to this realization that, hey, biology, genomics, gene regulation is actually really complicated, and we might need computational tools to try and decipher it?
I think it was all of the above. Yeah. It was a combination of all of those experiences of having this idea about when you start a project, you usually have some type of hypothesis of this is what I think the end result is going to look like. You may not know the gene or the specifics, but just the realization of project after project, it turned out to be an order of magnitude more complicated than I had thought at the outset.
And how long were you at Cambridge for?
So there about a year and a half.
Very cool.
Yeah, participating both in on their iGEM team and then doing the master's in computational biology.
Great. So you've come out of Cambridge. You've got this computational experience, and I suppose you're ready to go tackle the world. What did you do next?
So from there, I went to Harvard University to get a PhD in genetics and genomics because I thought, you know, if we're going to figure out and disentangle all of these complex human diseases, that has to be the place for it. I knew they had access to vast human data sets, and there were a lot of people there at the time with the thorough statistical knowledge to tackle this in a right, in the correct way, because obviously a lot of the early genome-wide association studies had many, many problems with them. And, you know, there was publication bias towards certain genes, all sorts of problems that made it very messy. And I thought they were beginning to do a great job at many universities, but particularly at the Harvard Genetics Department of doing things correctly.
And what did you study during your PhD? Who are you with?
So I did my PhD with Stephen McCarroll. And he was in the genetics department at Harvard Medical School. And his idea was that we should be looking at regions of complex structural variation in the human genome. And so these are regions that are affected by numerous structural mutations. So you could have an inversion followed by a series of tandem duplications, followed by a deletion. You know, a lot happens over millions of years of evolution, and these are really the spots in the genome that are not well captured by genome-wide association studies because they're highly complex, and that means that they're not really tagged or not associated with a single nucleotide polymorphism. And so really, if there were these mutations were causing large impacts on disease, we wouldn't really see them in genome-wide association studies. And so it was a good place to look for the next seriously damaging variant.
So after that experience and your PhD, what'd you do after that?
Yeah. So at the end of my PhD, you know, I think by many measures, it was successful. I found an association with one of these complex structural variants to cholesterol levels in people. And I thought, oh, great, victory. You know, we have found something that will matter to humanity. But as with most of these association studies, the mutation we were looking at really only had a small effect on cholesterol levels. And I think that's a common tale when people are doing genome-wide association studies that you find something, it's statistically significant. People say, oh, wow, look at that p-value. That's great. And then they look at the effect size and say, shrug, what are we going to do with that? And so from there, I started to look a bit outside of human genomics and look at what else was going on. And the Broad Institute at that time was just starting up this new project called Zoonomia, where the idea was that they could get whole genome reference sequences for over 200 mammals. And the idea was that if we compare hundreds of different mammals and we look at every single base, the ones that have not changed across all these mammals, so really about 100 million years of evolution, well, if they haven't changed, they're probably doing something very important.
Right, the conserved,
Yes. And so these are the highly conserved bases. And then if you bring that back to the human genome, you know right away, well, these are the genes, these are the base pairs that are actually having a very large impact on disease because they are not mutated. And so if you had a mutation there, you are a dead mammal. We know that from the outset.
Right.
And I suppose using coevolutionary information to predict fitness or to predict the impact of genetic mutation on the phenotype and on function is still really exciting. There's some work recently out of Deborah Mark's group, I suppose, that is very exciting work. What did you find out during your postdoc that inspired you to continue working in this space?
I think it was just this idea that we were finding lots of these base pairs throughout mammals that we know do something. And I think the work is starting right now to tie them back to human diseases and figure out exactly what they do. because that initial conservation analysis tells you it's important, mm-hmm. but it doesn't directly lead you to why.
Right.
And so
right.
a lot of that work is really being done now. Fauna Bio collaborates with that group at the Broad Institute to try to figure out why. And a lot of that comes from doing the analysis in a slightly different way. You might compare animals that are predisposed to certain diseases and ones that aren't and look at the differences in conservation. Mm-hmm. Fauna Bio, of course, studies hibernating mammals, and we can do that same sort of thing where we compare, well, what's highly conserved in all of the hibernators but not in other mammals. And so mm-hmm. that helps lead you toward, well, what is the actual function of these bases?
And even before Fauna and that entrepreneurship journey, you moved to California.
Yep.
Yeah. Why'd you move to California?
You know, a lot of that, in addition to this being an amazing space for mm-hmm. science, a lot of that was a family-related choice. So we were on the cusp of having kids, and I thought, well, that would be really nice to be in a location where we might get support from grandparents. Mm. And so both my husband and my family has lived out here, and so staying in Boston where we were isolated, I had numerous friends have kids and not have any family support locally. And it went way worse, I think, than people I knew who had grandparent support locally.
And I mean, I feel fondly about California as well. I have a bunch of family here, so I can understand that. And you ended up in a great place at Stanford. What'd you do there? And this was your second postdoc, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, it was sort of a transitional phase where I was working on the same types of projects that I had been doing at the Broad Institute, which was comparing mammalian genomes for different patterns of selection. Mm-hmm. The time I was looking at balancing selection, so trying to figure out what are genes that look highly diverse across all of mammals and what's the reason for that. And a lot of them turn out to be related to the immune system, because that's the best way we have to avoid pathogens is just by getting lots of mutations, being really diverse.
So Linda, let's talk about your entrepreneurship journey. When did you realize that you wanted to like launch a company or translate your discoveries into something impactful?
Absolutely. So I remember this moment. I was sitting in a retreat seminar when I was a PhD student at Harvard. Mm. And I was, you know, starting to get kind of excited about the discovery that our group was making around specific variants and cholesterol levels. And at that time, we heard a speaker from a large biopharma company come and talk to us. And I gotta admit, it was a bit of a downer. He said something like, you know, well, we see lots of papers coming out of high impact journals saying this gene contributes to disease in this way. And then we bring them in house and we can't get anything to replicate. So we always take academic science with a grain of salt. And I mean, my jaw dropped after that, because I thought what I was doing was important. I thought, you know, when I've found something that clearly could have an impact on human health, mm-hmm. that then I was passing the baton to large biopharma. They would see this, yeah. They would start studying it, and then eventually it might become a therapy if it proved useful. I think after hearing that and, you know, having that resonate with me for a few weeks, I thought, okay, so really the problem is if I believe in a specific target and I think this is going to work to cure human diseases, I need to carry that through myself, mm-hmm. because you cannot just trust that the work you have done will be picked up by others and right. carried forward, because that's not necessarily a realistic assumption.
Right. And there's no better person, I suppose, to make the discovery and to carry it forward than the person who discovered it in the first place.
Absolutely.
And you did exactly that. You gave us a little teaser earlier. You're now founder and CTO of a startup called Fauna Bio. Can you tell us about the journey to launching Fauna?
Absolutely. So I remember it very well. So our CEO and one of my fellow co-founders, Ashley Zender, and I used to sit together in Carlos Bustamante's lab at Stanford. And a frequent discussion of ours over coffee was the fact that there was starting to become a lot of mammal data and animal data generally that nobody was really using. It sort of seemed like it was still siloed off in this academic science of people collecting many different interesting samples from animals in nature. And it really wasn't going anywhere. And I was concerned that, you know, in biopharma, people probably still looked at this as sort of butterfly collecting and maybe not that relevant to what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And those of us that had a background in medical genomics, and Ashley's background was clinical. She's a clinical veterinarian. Mm. It was plainly obvious to us that a lot of this data would be useful. Just nobody on the other side realized that.
Mm.
We had to really think about and hone the idea for a while, because, of course, that's very vague. We want to take a lot of animal data and apply it into identifying good human therapies. So it wasn't really until we brought on our third co-founder, Katie Graybeck, who is also in the Bustamante lab, that we really narrowed in on exactly where we wanted to start and what we wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
So she has been working in the field of hibernation biology since she started her PhD with Sandy Martin. And she started telling us about some of the incredible adaptations that these animals have. Because I think, you know, when most people think about hibernation, they think about, oh, you know, bears, they go into caves.
Yeah.
They sit there during the winter. Who really knows what's going on? But I hadn't realized, you know, many, many mammals hibernate. It's throughout the mammalian tree. There are primates that hibernate. And it's actually a very dynamic process that is complicated, and it's very hard on the body. And so these animals have had to evolve many different resistance adaptations to prevent serious damage to numerous tissues in their bodies. So I'll give you a couple examples. We primarily work with the 13-line ground squirrel, though we are branching out into many other species. But so 13-line ground squirrels drop down to 4 degrees Celsius during the winter. And they do this around 25 times throughout the winter. And they go from this 4 degrees Celsius, they shoot up to the standard 37 degrees over 1 to 2 hours.
Oh, wow.
And then they keep doing this, you know, 25 times throughout the winter. And this is actually very akin to an ischemia reperfusion event, like you would get if you're getting a heart attack or a stroke.
Mm.
Yet they get very little damage. And the damage they do get, they're able to repair without creating fibrosis tissue.
Wow.
And so this is an excellent study system to try to figure out, well, how can we repair human hearts without getting this fibrotic tissue? But I mean, that's just a drop in the bucket of what these animals do. There's also applications for neurodegeneration. As they're entering hibernation, their neuronal connectivity disintegrates. They lose those connections. They develop hyperphosphorylated tau tangles. Looks just like an Alzheimer's brain, actually a very bad Alzheimer's brain.
Mm.
And then as they're leaving hibernation, they can clear all of these tau tangles, regrow the neurons. It's like they've been cured, like a miracle.
That's shocking. That's incredible. And these are still the squirrels who can do this?
These are still the squirrels. Yeah. Yeah.
Squirrels are formidable, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. And so they just have lots of adaptations that if we could figure out exactly how they are doing these and target the same genes would make excellent methods of translating these into human therapies.
Right. And I mean, anti-tau therapies are a focus now in the Alzheimer's field. They're very popular and lots of folks are currently pushing them through clinical trials. So I completely understand the relevance. And zooming out a little bit to where you are now, can you describe for a lay audience in just a couple of sentences, what do you do at FaunaBio?
Absolutely. So at FaunaBio, we are designing bio-inspired therapeutics. So that means that we identify animals that are resistant to or can repair human disease pathologies. So they've adapted methods to circumvent a lot of the diseases that humans would get. We figure out how they do that, and then we make a therapy out of it.
So it's you, Ashley and Katie from the Bustamante lab at Stanford, is that correct?
Yes, those are our three co-founders.
That's great. So you all are sitting there, you're ideating around this potential technology, you see a vision for this technology that could potentially be commercializable and impactful. How much time passed from that aha moment to when you actually launched FaunaBio?
You know, this is probably not a common tale. I think it was a matter of weeks.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
It just so happened that Ashley had run into Laura Deming at a seminar she was giving at Stanford. And she, you know, sort of pitched the idea to Laura, even though it was very early. And I think Laura was quite surprised and said, well, that's incredible. Did you know I'm just starting this accelerator called Age One, and maybe you should apply?
What was Age One then?
Age One was Laura Deming's accelerator to try to help out very new companies in the aging space.
And then what was the process, or I guess the challenges of spinning out the technology in that lab into an actual company?
Yeah, so I'd say a lot of the early challenges we suffered were similar to many of their early stage therapeutic companies where we were trying to figure out, okay, what are the key disease areas that we should focus on? Because of course, our first model for disease resistance is the 13-line ground squirrel. We also have a lot of other models, but the idea of just honing this down to what is really the best disease to go after, the best model, that was time consuming. And of course, that's not an easy process because I think we came into it thinking, let's tackle big diseases that affect a lot of people, like heart disease. And that was actually a quite a good fit for our model because these animals are getting these ischemia reperfusion events, heart attack and stroke. But then it turned out that a large proportion of biopharma was not really interested in partnering on that disease at this time. So it really is this interplay between, well, what are the diseases where we know we can be the most impactful? What is a good fit for our model? And then what is actually tractable as an indication currently. And so figuring out how to optimize all three of those was difficult.
And then what area did you decide to focus on?
So initially it was cardiovascular disorders. But yes, there was this kind of initial hiccup where we realized other companies didn't really want to partner on that as much. And so we quickly shifted gears to cardiac fibrosis and other types of fibrosis, also neurodegeneration and pulmonary fibrosis.
And do you have any suspicions why the big pharma companies weren't inclined to partner with cardiovascular diseases?
Yes, I think it's people like to call them graveyard indications, where there have been a lot of attempts over the last decade or so. And because there's a mountain of failures, people are just a bit more nervous about putting tons of money into that. Although, you know, our approach is substantially different from any of the other approaches that found those earlier drugs. But yeah, I think just right now, the appetite for pursuing those, at least in large biopharma, is depleted.
And once that appetite returns, if it ever does return in the future when technology advances, do you envision yourself at Fauna Bio pursuing and returning to cardiovascular disease?
Absolutely. We've got the targets. So why not?
So can you give us some example? You started off with the ground squirrel. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, so you started off with the ground squirrel. How has your vision evolved since then? How have you branched out? And do you have any other stories of exciting or extreme adaptations that are relevant to human health that over the past couple of years that you've discovered?
Absolutely. So I wouldn't say we've discovered them exactly at Fauna, but I think we always knew where we were going. This was always going to go beyond the ground squirrel. The hibernation adaptations are exciting and numerous. We also had a proprietary biobank, which we got from Katie's work with hibernators as a PhD student with Sandy Martin. So that was the first obvious species to tackle because they had so many different adaptations that we could study. But beyond that, you know, we're just starting to think about the spiny mouse, which is in Africa, and they are master regenerators of tissue. People always think about axolotls, and they're also great, but they're not mammals. So in terms of an evolutionary sense, it's possible that it won't line up quite as well with human medicine. So we're very excited about the spiny mouse. They can get extensive damage to tissues like their skin, their kidney, even their spinal cord, and then regenerate all of them without fibrotic tissue.
Wow. That's very awesome.
So, Linda, maybe you can walk us through the pipeline you use at Fauna Bio. Let's start with the biobank you mentioned, actually. So you take these animals, you sequence them, and then what do you do with that information?
Yeah, so we have their genomes, of course, and then we, particularly with hibernators, which, as I mentioned before, hibernation is a highly dynamic process. We have tissue samples from essentially the entire animal across 13 of these time points throughout hibernation. As I was alluding to earlier, it's very important to have these biobanks be precisely timed for phenotypes like neurodegeneration, where we know as they're entering hibernation, you get these neurons retracting. As they're leaving, they're regrowing. And so it's really those fine-grained time points mm-hmm. that matter. So we have 13 time points across hibernation. We do RNA sequencing across all of those time points, either bulk or single cell, depending mm-hmm. on exactly what we're going to do with the data. And then we analyze them, try to figure out both through comparisons with the physiology literature and also through looking in at a gene enrichments in terms of the different pathways we see, and try to hone in on, well, these are the time points that we absolutely know are going to be disease relevant. Mm-hmm. And then mm-hmm. doing a compare contrast between these time points of, well, what are the genes that are upregulated? What are the genes that are downregulated? Mm. And of course, we make these into these complicated transcriptomic networks and try to figure out what are the hubs of these networks mm-hmm. that are going to be the key players in terms of the ultimate phenotype of disease resistance.
And then how do you work back from animal sequencing to find the homologous genes in humans?
Yeah, so that question of homology is not usually a very difficult one. You can find these, you know, people have mapped the orthologs, like on NCBI, mm-hmm. you can find those. Mm-hmm. What we typically do to filter is we make sure that the percent identity, so how close the animal protein is to the human protein, mm-hmm. is still mm-hmm. quite high. Mm-hmm. And we do that not only for our protein of interest, but also for the entire network of genes that we're looking at, because mm-hmm. we want to make mm-hmm. sure we're comparing apples to apples.
Right.
Does this gene actually still function in a similar way in humans mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. what we see in these animals with exciting adaptations?
So then you find your gene of interest. How do you think about designing drugs for that particular gene? What's the modality you're looking at?
Yeah, absolutely. So typically, we have been fairly traditional in this respect. We are using small molecule compounds. We are open to other modalities if that seems like it might be important. But so far, we found a lot of success just with small molecules. So we either identify small molecules that already are targeting one of our key proteins of interest. Mm. We also have... So our whole platform itself is called Convergence, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. we have many different applications in this platform. One of them is LEO, and this stands for the L1000 Expression oh. Optimizer. And so we are using the Lynx L1000 data, which is, of course, many thousands of compounds that have been put on numerous different human cell lines, and they've monitored gene expression signatures that come mm-hmm. out. And so what this allows us to do is then mine this data and find compounds that recapitulate the gene expression signature that we know to be protective in animals. Mm-hmm. And so that leads us to a short list of compounds mm-hmm. that we think are doing something similar.
And when you're going through the discovery process, do you focus on the transcriptome exclusively, or do you also study the proteome and epigenome, et cetera?
Yeah, that's a great question. We also study the epigenome. We are starting to get more into proteomics as well, but we have not walked as far down that path. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I'm curious, so you've got this impressive sequencing repertoire, you know, across all these different tissue samples at specific time points. Can you walk us through a little bit more how you analyze that data to get to the hits? You mentioned it briefly, but I'm wondering how you go about assembling the genetic networks. What is the process like to identify those hub proteins, if you will?
Absolutely. So the two primary methods that we use are WGCNA. This is a weighted gene correlation mm-hmm. network analysis. Mm-hmm. And then we also use a separate software called AC3Net or CoreNet. And this mm-hmm. was developed by one of our computational biologists at FaunaBio. And mm-hmm. this gets you to directional networks. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so what we like to do is use both of those methods and integrate the results. And we found that really is how we hone in on some of our top candidates.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's great. And I've used WGCNA at length. It's Steve Horvath's group, I think it's from.
Absolutely.
Is that correct?
Yeah.
So you get these modules of gene expression that are highly correlated. Then I imagine you construct, is it using a public sort of interactome database to construct the network? How do you find the interactions between the various different components of your module to construct your network?
Yeah, so we look at the gene modules, and the first thing we like to do is look at enrichments, let's say, you know, using Reactome. Mm-hmm. We also layer in data from UK Biobank mm-hmm. and GWAS catalog and just try to make sure we're hitting in on modules that we know are going to be relevant to human diseases. Mm-hmm. What we love to do with the directional networks that we have through CoreNet, and that application is called Orca when it integrates with other types of data. Mm-hmm. We also have many people going through and mining transcriptomic literature for patients with certain diseases. Mm-hmm. And so what we do, I'll give you an example. If we're looking to find targets for cardiovascular disease, mm-hmm. and with the hibernators, we've identified networks that we know are, you know, turning on just as hibernators are repairing their hearts in a good way. They're not creating fibrotic tissue. And then we overlay on top of that human disease data from patients in heart failure versus normal controls. And then also animal models of this, such as mice that are in heart failure and are repairing their hearts, and also say neonatal mice that are repairing their mm-hmm. hearts also in a good way. Mm-hmm. And we're starting to see a lot of overlap between the way that a hibernator would repair their hearts without fibrosis. And it's looking a lot like the neonatal mice that are repairing their hearts without fibrosis. Mm-hmm. And so we try to, at Fauna, we call it omics overlay. We overlay many different data sets from exciting papers that we've mined and curated. And we think the more data, the better. You know, that's really going to land you in on the more impactful targets.
So, okay, Linda, so looking forward, what are the next steps for you in developing this platform a bit more, actually? Are there any unanswered questions that you kind of want to answer?
You know, I think where we take convergence from here is to just expand. The more species, the more data sets we can get, I think are really going to lead us to the best targets. And if you see a target working across numerous different species, like I see this is important in mouse, I see it's important in squirrel, I see this is important in high altitude chickens, I see it in high altitude pigs, that's going to make it way more likely that it's also going to work in humans because we see this throughout numerous different mammals working. We're not just talking about one solitary inbred mouse line that this happened mm-hmm. to work in. Because, I mean, I'm sure you've noticed a lot of those don't end up working when you take them into clinical trials. Yeah. So I think expanding across numerous different species is a goal of ours. We also recently released a new knowledge graph called Centaur, which is integrating human and animal data to make sure we're narrowing in on the best targets that we believe are also supported mm-hmm. by human genomics.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. That's interesting. Okay. How does that work?
So, yeah, it's an extremely large knowledge graph. About 40% of the data in it is from humans. You know, we're integrating data from UK Biobank, a lot of other human genomic sources, and it's essentially linking up a lot of the human patient data back to the gene modules that we're identifying not only in hibernators, but in other species we're starting to integrate in. A lot of the work, it's interesting, creating these knowledge graphs is just making sure that your disease mapping is correct because mm-hmm. obviously not all of these genes have been annotated previously in squirrels or in mice or in pigs as potentially being disease resistance. But when we see indications of that, we have to then say, all right, we're going to map it back to this phenotype and then connect it to humans. And so a lot of the nitty gritty work of that comes in making sure these mappings are correct. But then once it's there, it's extraordinarily powerful. And you can go and make these connections that you never would have made if you were just doing Google searches.
Yeah,
right. And I imagine you're seeking to expand your knowledge graph now with the addition of all these new species. Can you speak to a little bit in the future? How do you plan to acquire access to all of these species? Do you have them in-house at Fauna, or do you partner with folks in the field to get access?
Absolutely. So we partner with academic labs primarily mm-hmm. that are interested in seeing a lot of the really exciting work that they are doing end up being meaningful and being translated into human therapies. Mm-hmm. It is difficult sometimes to make sure you're finding the right partnership that's going to benefit both parties. But in some way, we have this advantage in that we were all recently academics and knew a lot of people who are doing field biology and working with a lot of these organisms.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Lena, so we want you to stretch and find your most optimistic self.
I will try.
Imagine it's 10 years from now. What has Fauna done? What are you most excited about to accomplish?
I want to see a lot of the early stage, super exciting results that we are seeing out of Fauna in patients. Mm. I think 10 years from now, I would love to see our therapies actually curing people. My stepmom actually suffers from pulmonary fibrosis. And every day I sit there and think, wow, we're seeing these exciting results that are coming out of our platform, that in vivo we see these animals getting way lower fibrosis levels than the controls. Wouldn't it be nice if we could push this forward faster to try to help her? But yes, I would love to see numerous therapies that we're currently working on actually in people. And, you know, at Fauna, I think we have a fairly broad view on what is going to be helpful for the future of humanity. So in addition to curing diseases, we're going a bit beyond that because, you know, we're a hibernation company to some extent. We're also integrating a lot of other animals to try to come up with new therapies. But because we are sitting on this wealth of hibernation data, anyone who's ever seen a sci-fi movie will tell you that the way we are going to do long-range space travel is hibernation. I think everybody knows this. You know, people like to think that this is fairly far off, and it might be, but we are laying the groundwork for that right now at Fauna Bio. So in addition to studying diseases, which are very important, we are also working to identify hibernation induction triggers that we believe will be functional in humans.
Wow, that's very exciting. I'm sorry to hear about your stepmom, but I know there's no better motivation than working for a better future for our loved ones. And the work on hibernation for long-range space travel, that's the future. Thanks so much for joining us on Translation, Linda.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be here.
Hi again, this is Ayush, biology fellow at 50 Years. I'm back with Linda Goodman after our initial recording. We're recording an update after the Xenomia Project papers have now been released in a special issue of Science, which has been all over Twitter and of which Linda and Fauna Bio were important members of the Xenomia Consortium. Hi Linda, how are you?
Hi Ayush, I'm doing great. I'm happy to be here.
Tell us a little bit more about the Xenomia Project.
Yes, so the Xenomia Project was this massive undertaking led by Shostin Lindblad-Toe and Eleanor Carlson at the Broad Institute. This is a really large collaboration with over 150 researchers spread across 7 different time zones. And as you mentioned, this was just published in a special issue of Science Magazine, which included 11 different research articles. And so the general idea of Xenomia is that we sequence large numbers of mammals, in this case, 240 mammal genomes, and look for individual base pair nucleotides that are the same across these mammals. And the idea is really that, so mutations are always happening in DNA, but if we don't see a mutation across all of these mammals, it implies that it is very important to health, because it means that if you had a mutation there, you were a dead mammal. And so we are not seeing your sequence. And so this is a great way to understand the individual base pairs that are undergoing what we call evolutionary constraint.
That's super interesting. Tell us more about how Fauna Bio was involved with the Xenomia Project.
Yes. So evolutionary constraint is amazing because you now know the really important base pairs in the human genome, the base pairs that are essential for human health and longevity. But it doesn't tell you why. It just says that it's really important. So other analyses that we can do with these data are compare groups of mammals with different traits. So say mammals with really small brains compared to mammals with really large brains, or long-lived versus short-lived mammals, or hibernation versus animals that cannot hibernate, which, of course, as you know, is near and dear to Fauna's heart. So we worked on this hibernation analysis. And this only works if you have a sufficient number of animals in each category. But as you know, hibernators are in every major mammalian clade. In this case, we had 22 deep hibernators. And so these were species that are capable of getting their core temperature depressed below 18 degrees Celsius for more than 24 hours. And, you know, the standard, what you and I are at, is around 37 degrees Celsius. So these guys are pretty cold. Mm-hmm. And we can compare these animals to the 150 strict homeotherms. So these are species that maintain just a constant body temperature. And we found a lot of really interesting genes like MFN2, TXNIP, and PINK1. These are really involved in altering mitochondrial pathways that are necessary for things like metabolic suppression, which of course is essential to hibernation.
That's fascinating and clearly relevant to human health. But if we're trying to learn more about the human genome, Linda, why wouldn't we sequence more humans with diseases? Tell us why you think we need to sequence animals.
Yes, great question. And so it turns out over, you know, the past decade or so, the vast majority of sequencing that we've been doing is, in fact, in humans. It dwarfs the amount of sequencing that we're doing in other animals. And I definitely understand why people want to cure diseases, but this is actually statistically a very poor choice, and I'll explain why. It's because, unfortunately, we're all very similar. If you take two random people, say you and I, we have a difference on average every 1,000 base pairs. So that means that the vast majority of the sequencing we're doing is sequencing the same letters over and over and over. And because we're all so similar, it's actually hard to tell which base pairs are important. It's hard to say, is this base not mutated in humans because it makes someone very sick, or is it just random? And when we're talking about humans, it's actually mostly just random. So if you take 70,000 humans and you identify all of the base pairs that are not mutated, and you try to ask, okay, does this mean that these are important for human health? You actually expect around 2.6 billion false positives. So you're going to be wrong most of the time.
Wow.
So there's not that much information content in humans for this type of analysis. But because mammals as a whole are not so closely related, we can look at just 240 mammals. And when we're doing the same type of analysis, when we're saying this base pair isn't mutated, is this meaningful? We actually expect only around 200 false positives. And this is amazing. This is the very first time that we've ever been able to look at a single base in the human genome and say, we know this particular base is important.
That's so exciting. Tell us about how the Xenomia Consortium came together. And I know there might be a story here. Tell us about how the consortium decided on the name Xenomia.
Yeah, so that's a great question. So years ago, the Broad Institute had the 29 mammal project, which for its time was an amazing number of mammals. It was much harder to sequence new genomes back at that time. The original idea behind the Xenomia project would be sequencing 200 mammals, and we had calculated out that this would be about the number of mammals that would be needed to get to this single base resolution to say this individual nucleotide base pair is important. But gradually, we realized we could get in a few more mammals, so then it became the 240 mammals project, and, you know, it just, because it kept growing, we decided it needed some rebranding and decided on the Xenomia name. So if the exact number of mammals changed a bit, it would be all right.
Awesome. And you've now published a series of seminal papers in Science Magazine. Looking forward, what's next for both the Xenomia Project and for FaunaBio?
Yes, so I think the Xenomia Project is likely to be sequencing even more mammals in the future. You know, the more data, the better with these types of analyses. And in terms of fauna, we're going to continue to collaborate with Xenomia. And really, now that all of this data is publicly available, we're just going to get ingested into our platform called Convergence as fast as possible, because many of the analyses and the data sets are extremely relevant for human health and identifying the next target genes. And really what I've described for you here today is just scratching the surface of what Zoonomia is. I would encourage everybody to actually go to the issue of Science and take a look at the other papers. And all of the data is publicly available at zoonomiaproject.org.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for the update, Linda. We're excited to see how the Zoonomia Project can continue to apply advances in DNA sequencing to understand how these genomes are generating animal diversity and produce insights relevant to human health. And as you said, listeners who are interested can learn more in the special Zoonomia issue of Science Magazine, which is out now.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that episode of Translation. If you're an author of an upcoming paper in bio or know of any interesting papers dropping soon and want to hear from the authors, send us an email to translation@50.vc. We'd love to hear from you. Until next time, good bio.